shooting. No, I mean, when was it that you were shown this photo?
Just this morning. Detective Bosch came to the office with it.
The judge nodded. We were quiet for a moment, and then the judge got to the point of the meeting.
Okay, Mr. Haller, why don't we talk about clients and cases now?
Yes, Your Honor. I reached down and unzipped my bag, taking out the scorecard Lorna had prepared for me. Judge Holder kept me at her desk for the next hour while I went over every case and client, detailing the status and conversations I'd had with each. By the time she finally let me go, I was late for my 11 o'clock hearing in Judge Stanton's chambers. I left Holder's court and didn't bother with the elevators. I hit the exit stairs and charged up two flights to the floor where Stanton's courtroom was located. I was running 8 minutes late and wondered if it was going to cost me another donation to another judge's favorite charity. The courtroom was empty, but Stanton's clerk was in her corral. She pointed with a pen to the open door to the hallway leading to the judge's chambers.
They're waiting for you, she said.
I quickly moved by her and down the hall. The door to the chambers was open, and I saw the judge sitting behind his desk. To his left rear side was a stenographer, and across the desk from him were three chairs. Walter Elliott was sitting in the chair to the right, the middle chair was empty, and Jeffrey Golentz was in the third. I had never met the prosecutor before, but he was recognizable because I had seen his face on TV and in the newspapers. In the last few years, he had successfully handled a series of high-profile cases and was making a name for himself. He was the undefeated up-and-comer in the DA's office. I loved going up against undefeated prosecutors. Their confidence often betrayed them.
Sorry I'm late, Your Honor, I said as I slid into the empty seat. Judge Holder called me into a hearing and she ran long. I hoped that mentioning the chief judge as the reason for my tardiness would keep Stanton from further assaulting my checkbook, and it seemed to work.
Let's go on the record now, he said.
The stenographer leaned forward and put her fingers on the keys of her machine.
In the matter of California versus Walter Elliott, we are in chambers today for a status conference. Present is the defendant, along with Mr. Golentz for the state, and Mr. Haller, who is here in the late Mr. Vincent's stead.
The judge had to break there to give the stenographer the proper spellings of all the names. He spoke in an authoritative voice that a decade on the bench often gives a jurist. The judge was a handsome man with a full head of bristly gray hair. He was in good shape, the black robe doing little to disguise his well-developed shoulders and chest.
So, he then said, we're scheduled in this matter for voir dire next Thursday, a week from today, and I notice, Mr. Haller, that I have received no motion from you to continue the matter while you get up to speed on the case.
We don't want a delay, Elliot said.
I reached over and put my hand on my client's forearm and shook my head.
Mr. Elliot, in this session I want you to let your lawyer do the talking, the judge said.
Sorry, Your Honor, I said, but the message is the same whether from me or directly from Mr. Elliot. We want no delay. I have spent the week getting up to speed, and I will be prepared to begin jury selection next Thursday.
The judge squinted his eyes at me.
You sure about that, Mr. Haller?
Absolutely. Mr. Vincent was a good lawyer, and he kept thorough records. I understand the strategy he built and will be ready to go on Thursday. The case has my full attention, that of my staff as well.
The judge leaned back in his high-backed chair and swiveled side to side as he thought. He finally looked at Elliot.
Mr. Elliot, it turns out you do get to speak after all. I would like to hear directly from you that you are in full agreement with your new attorney here, and that you understand the risk you run, bringing in a fresh lawyer so close to the start of trial. It's your freedom at stake here, sir. Let's hear what you have to say about it.
Elliot leaned forward and spoke in a defiant tone.
Judge, first of all, I am in complete agreement. I want to get this thing to trial so I can blow the district attorney here right out of the water. I am an innocent man, being persecuted and prosecuted for something I did not do. I don't want to spend a single extra day as the accused, sir. I loved my wife, and I'll miss her forever. I didn't kill her, and it pierces my heart when I hear the people on TV saying these vile things about me. What hurts the most is knowing that the real killer is out there someplace. The sooner Mr. Haller gets to prove my innocence to the world, the better.
It was O.J. 101, but the judge studied Elliot and nodded thoughtfully, then turned his attention to the prosecutor.
Mr. Golentz,
What is the state's view of this?
The deputy district attorney cleared his throat. The word to describe him was telegenic. He was handsome and dark, and his eyes seemed to carry the very wrath of justice in them.
Your Honor, the state is prepared for trial and has no objection to proceeding on schedule. But I would ask that if Mr. Elliott is so sure about proceeding without delay, he formally waive any appellate redress in this regard should things not go as he predicts in trial.
The judge swiveled his chair so that his focus could go back on me.
What about that, Mr. Holler?
Your Honor, I don't think it's necessary for my client to waive any protections that might be afforded to—
I don't mind, Elliott said, cutting in on me. I'll waive whatever you damn well please. I want to go to trial.
I looked sharply at him. He looked at me and shrugged.
We're going to win this thing, he explained.
You want to take a moment in the corridor, Mr. Holler? The judge asked.
Thank you, Judge.
I got up and signaled Elliott up.
Come with me.
We walked out into the short hallway that led to the courtroom. I closed the door behind us. Elliott spoke before I could, underlining the problem.
Look, I want this thing over, and I—
Shut up! I said in a forced whisper.
What? You heard me. Shut the fuck up. You understand? I am sure you are quite used to talking whenever you want, and having everybody listen to every brilliant word you say. But you are not in Hollywood anymore, Walter. You aren't talking make-believe movies with this week's Mogolito. You understand what I'm saying? This is real life. You don't speak unless you are spoken to. If you have something to say otherwise, then you whisper it into my ear, and if I think it's worth repeating, then I, not you, will say it to the judge. You got it?
It took Elliott a long time to answer. His face turned dark, and I understood that I might be about to lose the franchise. But in the moment, I didn't care. What I had said needed to be said. It was a welcome to my world speech that was long overdue.
Yes, he finally said. I get it.
Good. Then remember it. Now let's go back in there and see if we can avoid giving away your right to appeal if you happen to get convicted, because I fucked up by being unprepared for trial.
That won't happen. I have faith in you.
I appreciate that, Walter.
But the truth is, you have no basis for that faith. And whether you do or don't, it doesn't mean we have to give anything away. Let's go back in now and let me do the talking. That's why I get the big bucks, right?
I clapped him on the shoulder. We went in and sat back down, and Walter didn't say another word. I argued that he shouldn't have to give away his right to appellate review just because he wanted the speedy trial he was entitled to. But Judge Stanton sided with Golentz, ruling that if Elliott declined the offer to delay the trial, he couldn't come complaining after a conviction that his attorney hadn't had enough time to prepare. Faced with the ruling, Elliott stuck to his guns and declined the delay, as I knew he would. That was okay with me. Under the Byzantine rules of law, almost nothing was safe from appeal. I knew that if necessary, Elliott would still be able to appeal the ruling the judge had just made. We moved on to what the judge called housekeeping after that. The first order of business was to have both sides sign off on a motion from Court TV to be allowed to broadcast segments of the trial live on its daily programming. Neither I nor Golentz objected. After all, it was free advertising. Me for new clients, Golentz to further his political aspirations. And as far as Walter Elliott was concerned, he whispered to me that he wanted the cameras there to record his not guilty verdict. Next, the judge outlined the schedule for submitting final discovery and witness lists. He gave us until Monday on the discovery materials, and the witness lists were due the day after that.
No exceptions, gentlemen, he said.
I look dimly on surprise additions after deadline. This was not going to be a problem from the defense's side of the aisle. Vincent had already made two previous discovery filings, and there was very little new since then for me to share with the prosecution. Sisko was doing a good job of keeping me in the dark as to what he was finding out about Riltz, and what I didn't know, I couldn't put in the discovery file. When it comes to witnesses, my plan was to give Golentz the usual runaround. I would be submitting a list of potential witnesses, naming every law officer and forensic tech mentioned in the sheriff's reports. That was standard operating procedure.
Golentz would have to puzzle over who I really would call to testify and who is important to the defense's case.
All right, guys. I've probably got a courtroom full of lawyers out there waiting for me, Stanton finally said. Are we clear on everything?
Golentz and I nodded our heads. I couldn't help but wonder if either the judge or the prosecutor was the recipient of the bribe. Was I sitting with the man who had turned the case my client's way? If so, he had done nothing to give himself away.
I finished the meeting thinking that Bosch had it all wrong. There was no bribe. There was a $100,000 boat somewhere in a harbor in San Diego or Cabo, and it had Jerry Vincent's name on the title.
Okay, then, the judge said. We'll get this going next week. We can talk about ground rules Thursday morning, but I want to make it clear right now. I'm going to run this trial like a well-oiled machine. No surprises, no shenanigans, no funny stuff. Again, are we clear?
Golentz and I both agreed once more that we were clear, but the judge swiveled his chair and looked directly at me. He squinted his eyes in suspicion.
I'm going to hold you to that, he said.
It seemed to be a message intended only for me, a message that would never show on the stenographer's record.
How come, I wondered, it's always the defense attorney who gets the judicial squint?
I got to Joanne Giorgetti's office shortly before the noon break. I knew that getting there a minute after 12 would be too late. The DA's office is literally empty during the lunch hour, the inhabitants seeking sunlight, fresh air, and sustenance outside the CCB. I told the receptionist I had an appointment with Giorgetti, and she made a call. Then she buzzed the door lock and told me to go back. Giorgetti had a small, windowless office, with most of the floor space taken up by cardboard file boxes. It was the same way in every prosecutor's office I'd ever been in, big or small. She was at her desk, but was hidden behind a wall of stacked motions and files. I carefully reached over the wall to shake her hand.
How's it going, Joanne?
Not bad, Mickey. How about you?
I'm doing okay. You just got a lot of cases, I hear.
Yeah, quite a few.
The conversation was stilted. I knew she and Maggie were tight, and there was no telling whether my ex-wife had opened up to her about my difficulties in the past year.
So you're here for whims?
That's right.
I didn't even know I had the case till this morning.
She handed me a file with an inch-thick stack of documents in it.
What do you think happened to Jerry's file? She asked.
I think maybe the killer took it.
She made a cringing face.
Weird. Why would the killer take this file?
Probably unintended. The file was in Jerry's briefcase along with his laptop, and the killer just took the whole thing.
Well, is there anything unusual about this case? Anything that would have made Jerry a target?
I don't think so. Just your usual everyday crazy with a gun sort of thing.
I nodded.
Have you heard anything about a federal grand jury taking a look at the state courts?
She knitted her eyebrows.
Why would they be looking at this case?
I'm not saying they were. I've been out of the loop for a while. I was wondering what you've heard.
She shrugged.
Just the usual rumors on the gossip circuit. Seems like there's always a federal investigation of something.
Yeah. I said nothing else, hoping she would fill me in on the rumor. But she didn't, and it was time to move on.
The hearing today is to set a trial date? I asked.
Yes, but I assume you'll want a continuance so you can get up to speed.
Well, let me go look at the file during lunch, and I'll let you know if that's what the plan is.
Okay, Mickey, but just so you know, I won't oppose a continuance, considering what happened with Jerry.
Thanks, Kojo.
She smiled as I used the name her young basketball players called her by at the Y.
You seen Maggie lately? She asked.
Saw her last night when I went to pick up Haley. She seems to be doing okay. Have you seen her?
Just at basketball practice. But she usually sits there with her nose in a file. We used to go out after with the girls to Hamburger Hamlet, but Maggie's been too busy.
I nodded. She and Maggie had been foxhole buddies since day one, coming up through the ranks of the prosecutor's office. Competitors, but not competitive with each other. But time goes by, and distances work their way into any relationship.
Well, I'll take this and look it all over, I said.
The hearing's with Friedman at 2, right?
Yeah, 2. I'll see you then.
Thanks for doing this, Joanne.
No problem.
I left the DA's office and waited 10 minutes to get on an elevator with the lunch crowd. The last one on, I rode down with my face 2 inches from the door. I hated the elevators more than anything else in the entire criminal court's building.
Hey, Haller.
It was a voice from behind me. I didn't recognize it, but it was too crowded for me to turn around to see who it was.
What? Heard you scored all of Vincent's cases.
I wasn't going to discuss my business in a crowded elevator. I didn't respond. We finally hit bottom, and the doors spread open. I stepped out and looked back for the person who had spoken. It was Dan Daly, another defense attorney who was part of a coterie of lawyers who took in Dodgers games occasionally and martinis routinely at Four Green Fields. I had missed the last season of booze and baseball. How you doing, Dan? We shook hands, an indication of how long it had been since we'd seen each other.
So, who'd you grease?
He said it with a smile, but I could tell there was something behind it. Maybe a dose of jealousy over my scoring the Elliott case. Every lawyer in town knew it was a franchise case. It could pay top dollar for years. First the trial, and then the appeals that would come after a conviction.
Nobody, I said. Jerry put me in his will.
We started walking toward the exit doors. Daly's ponytail was longer and grayer. But what was most notable was that it was intricately braided. I hadn't seen that before.
Then lucky you, Daly said. Let me know if you need a second chair on Elliott.
He wants only one lawyer at the table, Dan. He said no dream team.
Well, then keep me in mind as a writer in regard to the rest.
This meant he was available to write appeals on any convictions my new set of clients might incur. Daly had forged a solid reputation as an expert appeals man with a good batting average.
I'll do that, I said. I'm still reviewing everything.
Good enough. We came through the doors and I could see the Lincoln at the curb, waiting. Daly was going the other way. I told him I'd keep in touch.
We miss you at the bar, Mick, he said over his shoulder.
I'll drop by, I called back. But I knew I wouldn't drop by, that I had to stay away from places like that. I got in the back of the Lincoln. I tell my drivers never to get out and open the door for me, and told Patrick to take me over to Chinese Friends on Broadway. I told him to drop me and go get lunch on his own. I needed to sit and read and didn't want any conversation. I got to the restaurant between the first and second waves of patrons and waited no more than 5 minutes for a table. Wanting to get to work immediately, I ordered a plate of fried pork chops right away. I knew they would be perfect. They were paper thin and delicious, and I'd be able to eat them with my fingers without taking my eyes off the WIMS documents. I opened the file Joanne Giorgetti had given me. It contained copies only of what the prosecutor had turned over to Jerry Vincent under the rules of discovery, primarily sheriff's documents relating to the incident, arrest, and follow-up investigation. Any notes, strategies, or defense documents that Vincent had generated were lost with the original file. The natural starting point was the arrest report, which included the initial and most basic summary of what had transpired. As is often the case, it started with 911 calls to the County Communications and Dispatch Center. Multiple reports of gunfire came in from a neighborhood next to a park in Calabasas. The calls fell under Sheriff's Department jurisdiction because Calabasas was in an unincorporated area north of Malibu and near the western limits of the county. The first deputy to respond was listed on the report as Todd Stallworth. He worked the night shift out of the Malibu substation and had been dispatched at 10:21 p.m. to the neighborhood off Las Virgenes Road. From there, he was directed into the nearby Malibu Creek State Park, where the shots were being fired. Now hearing shots himself, Stallworth called for backup and drove into the park to investigate. There were no lights in the rugged mountain park, as it was posted closed at sunset. As Stallworth entered on the main road, the headlights of his patrol car picked up a reflection, and the deputy saw a vehicle parked in a clearing ahead. He put on his spotlight and illuminated a pickup truck with its tailgate down. There was a pyramid of beer cans on the tailgate and what looked like a gun bag with several rifle barrels protruding from it. Stallworth stopped his car 80 yards from the pickup and decided to wait until backup arrived. He was on the radio to the Malibu station, describing the pickup truck and saying that he was not close enough to read its license plate, when suddenly there was a gunshot, and the searchlight located above the side view mirror exploded with the bullet's impact. Stallworth killed the rest of the car's lights and bailed out, crawling into the cover of some bushes that lined the clearing. He used his handheld radio to call for additional backup and the Special Weapons and Tactics team. A 3-hour standoff ensued, with the gunman hidden in the wooded terrain near the clearing. He fired his weapon repeatedly, but apparently his aim was at the sky. No deputies were struck by bullets. No other vehicles were damaged. Finally, a deputy in black SWAT gear worked his way close enough to the pickup truck to read the license plate by using high-powered binoculars equipped with night vision lenses. The plate number led to the name Eli Wims, which in turn led to a cell phone number. The shooter answered on the first ring, and a SWAT team negotiator began a conversation. The shooter was indeed Eli Wims, a 44-year-old house painter from Englewood. He was characterized in the arrest report as drunk, angry, and suicidal. Earlier in the day, he had been kicked out of his home by his wife, who informed him that she was in love with another man. Wims had driven to the ocean, and then north to Malibu, and then over the mountains to Calabasas. He saw the park and thought it looked like a good place to stop the truck and sleep, but he drove on by and bought a case of beer at a gas station near the 101 freeway. He then turned around and went back to the park. Wims told the negotiator that he started shooting because he heard noises in the dark and was afraid. He believed he was shooting at rabid coyotes that wanted to eat him. He said he could see their red eyes glowing in the dark. He said he shot out the spotlight on the first patrol car that arrived because he was afraid the light would give his position away to the animals. When asked about the shot from 80 yards, he said he had qualified as an expert marksman during the first war in Iraq. The report estimated that Wims fired at least 27 times while deputies were on the scene, and dozens of times before that. Investigators eventually collected a total of 94 spent bullet casings. Wims did not surrender that night until he ran out of beer. Shortly after crushing the last empty in his hand, he told the cell phone negotiator that he would trade one rifle for a 6-pack of beer. He was turned down. He then announced that he was sorry and ready for the incident and everything else to be over, that he was going to kill himself and literally go out with a bang. The negotiator tried to talk him out of it and kept the conversation going while a 2-man SWAT unit moved through the heavy terrain toward his position in a dense stand of eucalyptus trees. But soon the negotiator heard snoring on the cell line. Wims had passed out. The SWAT team moved in, and Wims was captured without a shot being fired by law enforcement. Order was restored. Since Deputy Stallworth had taken the initial call and was the one fired upon, he was given the collar. The gunman was placed in Stallworth's squad car and transported to the Malibu substation and jailed. Other documents in the file continued the Eli Wims saga. At his arraignment, the morning after his arrest, Wims was declared indigent and assigned a public defender. The case moved slowly in the system, with Wims being held in the Men's Central Jail. But then, Vincent stepped in and offered his services pro bono. His first order of business was to ask for and receive a competency evaluation of his client. This had the effect of slowing the case down even further, as Wims was carted off to the state hospital in Camarillo for a 90-day psych evaluation. That evaluation period was over, and the reports were now in. All of the doctors who examined, tested, and talked to Wims in Camarillo had agreed that he was competent and ready to stand trial. In the hearing scheduled before Judge Mark Friedman at 2, a trial date would be set and the case clock would begin to tick again. To me, it was all a formality. One read of the case documents, and I knew there would be no trial. What the day's hearing would do was set the time period I would have to negotiate a plea agreement for my client. It was a cut-and-dried case. Wims would enter a plea and probably face a year or two of incarceration and mental health counseling. The only question I got from my survey of the file was why Vincent had taken the case in the first place. It didn't fall into line with the kinds of cases he usually handled with paying or high-profile clients. There didn't seem to be much of a challenge to the case either. It was routine, and Wims' crime wasn't even unusual. Was it simply a case Jerry took on to satisfy a need for pro bono work? It seemed to me, if that was the case, that Vincent could have found something more interesting, which would pay off in other ways, such as publicity. The Wims case had initially drawn media attention because of the public spectacle in the park, but when it came to trial or disposition of the case, it would likely fly well below the media radar. My next thought was to suspect that there was a connection to the Elliott case. Vincent had found some sort of link. but on first read, I couldn't nail it down. There were two general connections, in that the Wims incident had happened less than 12 hours before the Beach House murders, and both crimes had occurred in the Sheriff's Department's Malibu District. But those connections didn't hold up to further scrutiny. In terms of topography, they weren't remotely connected. The murders were on the beach, and the Wims shooting spree took place far inland, in the county park on the other side of the mountains. As far as I could recall, none of the names in the Wims file were mentioned in the Elliott materials I had reviewed. The Wims incident happened on the night shift, the Elliott murders on the day shift. I couldn't nail down any specific connection, and in great frustration closed the file with the question unanswered. I checked my watch and saw I had to get back to the CCB if I wanted time to meet my client in lockup before the 2 o'clock hearing. I called Patrick to come get me, paid for lunch, and stepped out to the curb. I was on my cell, talking with Lorna, when the Lincoln pulled up and I jumped into the back. "Has Cisco met with Carlin yet?" I asked her. "No, that's at 2. Have Cisco ask him about the Wims case, too."
"Okay, what about it?"
"Ask him why Vincent even took it."
"You think they're connected, Elliott and Wims?"
"I think it, but I don't see it."
"Okay, I'll tell him."
"Anything else going on?"
"Not at the moment. You're getting a lot of calls from the media. Who's this guy Jack McAvoy?"
The name rang a bell, but I couldn't place it.
"I don't know. Who is he?"
"He works at the Times. He called up all huffy about not hearing from you, saying you had an exclusive deal with him." Now I remembered. The two-way street.
"Don't worry about him. I haven't heard from him either. What else?"
"Court TV wants to sit down and talk about Elliott. They're going to carry live coverage throughout the trial, making it their feature. And so they're hoping to get daily commentary from you at the end of court each day."
"What do you think, Lorna?"
"I think it's like free national advertising.
You better do it. They told me they're giving the trial its own logo wrap at the bottom of the screen. Murder in Malibu, they're calling it."
"Then set it up. What else?"
"Well, while we're on the subject, I got a notice a week ago that your bus bench contract expires at the end of the month. I was just going to let it go because there was no money, but now you're back, and you've got money. Should we renew?"
For the past 6 years, I had advertised on bus benches strategically located in high crime and traffic locations around the city. Although I had dropped out for the past year, the benches still spawned a steady stream of calls, all of which Lorna deferred or referred.
"That's a 2-year contract, right?"
"Yes."
I made a quick decision.
"Okay, renew it. Anything else?"
"That's it from here. Oh, wait, one other thing. The landlord for the building came in today. Called herself the leasing agent, which is just a fancy way of saying landlord. She wants to know if we're going to keep the office. Jerry's death is a lease breaker if we want it to be. I got the feeling there's a waiting list on the building, and this is an opportunity to jack the rent up for the next lawyer who comes in here."
I looked out the window of the Lincoln as we cruised across the 101 overpass and back into the Civic Center area. I could see the newly built Catholic Cathedral and past that, the waving steel skin of the Disney Concert Hall. It caught the sunlight and took on a warm orange glow. "I don't know, Lorna. I like working from the back seat here. It's never boring. What do you think?"
"I'm not particularly fond of putting on makeup every morning."
Meaning she liked working out of her condo more than she liked getting ready and driving downtown to an office each day. As usual, we were on the same page.
"Something to think about," I said. "No makeup, no office overhead, no fighting for a spot in the parking garage."
She didn't respond. It was going to be my call. I looked ahead and saw we were a block from my drop-off point in front of the CCB.
"Let's talk about it later," I said. "I gotta jump out."
"Okay, Mickey. Be safe."
"You too." Eli Wims was still doped up from the 3 months he'd spent in Camarillo. He'd been sent back to county with a prescription for a drug therapy that wasn't going to help me defend him, let alone help him answer any questions about possible connections to the murders on the beach. It took me less than 2 minutes in courtside lockup to grasp the situation and to decide to submit a motion to Judge Friedman, requesting that all drug therapy be halted. I went back to the courtroom and found Joanne Giorgetti at her place at the prosecution table. The hearing was scheduled to start in 5 minutes. She was writing something on the inside flap of a file when I walked up to the table. Without looking up, she somehow knew it was me.
You want a continuance, don't you? And a cease and desist on the drugs. The guy's a zombie. She stopped writing and looked up at me. Considering he was pot-shotting my deputies, I'm not sure I object to his being in that condition. But Joanne, I've got to be able to ask the guy basic questions in order to defend him. Really? She said it with a smile, but the point was taken. I shrugged and crouched down, so we were on an even eye line. You're right. I don't think we're talking about a trial here, I said. I'd be happy to listen to any offers. Your client shot at an occupied sheriff's car. The state is interested in sending a message on this one. We don't like people doing that. She folded her arms to signal the state's unwillingness to compromise on this. She was an attractive and athletically built woman. She drummed her fingers on one of her biceps, and I couldn't help but notice the red fingernail polish. As long as I could remember dealing with Joanne Giorgetti, her nails were always painted blood red. She did more than represent the state. She represented cops who had been shot at, assaulted, ambushed, and spit on. And she wanted the blood of every miscreant who had the bad luck to be prosecuted by her. I would argue that my client, panicked as he was by the coyotes, was shooting at the light on the car, not into the car. Your own documents say he was an expert marksman in the U.S. Army. If he wanted to shoot the deputy, he could have, but he didn't. He was discharged from the Army 15 years ago, Mickey. Right, but some skills never go away, like riding a bike. Well, that's an argument you could surely make to the jury. My knees were about to give out. I reached over to one of the chairs at the defense table, wheeled it over, and sat down. Sure, I can make that argument. But it is probably in the state's best interest to bring this case to a close. Get Mr. Wims off the street and into some sort of therapy that will help prevent this from ever happening again. So what do you say? Should we go off into a corner someplace and work this out, or go at it in front of a jury? She thought for a moment before responding. It was the classic prosecutor's dilemma. It was a case she could easily win. She had to decide whether to pad her stats or do what might be the right thing. As long as I get to pick the corner, that's fine with me. Okay, I won't oppose a continuance if you make the motion. Sounds good, Joanne. What about the drug therapy? I don't want this guy acting out again, even in Men's Central. Look, wait till they bring him out. You'll see, he's a zombie. You don't want this to go down and then have him challenge the deal because the state made him incompetent to make a decision. Let's get his head clear, do the deal, and then you can have them pump him up with whatever you want. She thought about it, saw the logic, and finally nodded. But if he acts out in jail one time, I'm going to blame you and take it out on him. I laughed. The idea of blaming me was absurd. Whatever. I got up and started to push the chair back to the defense table, but then I turned back to the prosecutor. Joanne, let me ask you something else. Why did Jerry Vincent take on this case? She shrugged and shook her head. I don't know. Well, did it surprise you? Sure. It was kind of strange, him showing up. I knew him from way back when, you know? Meaning when he was a prosecutor. Yeah, so what happened? One day, a few months ago, I got notice of a competency motion on Wims, and Jerry's name was on it. I called him up and said, what the hell, you know? You don't even call to say, I'm taking over the case? And he just said he wanted to get some pro bono in and ask the PD for a case. But I know Angel Romero, the PD who had the case originally. A couple of months back, I ran into him on one of the floors, and he asked me what was happening on Wims. And in the course of the conversation, he told me that Jerry didn't just come in asking for a PB referral. He went to Wims first in Men's Central, signed him up, and then came in and told Angel to turn over the file. Why do you think he took the case? I've learned over the years that sometimes if you ask the same question more than once, you get different responses. I don't know. I specifically asked him that, and he didn't really answer. He changed the subject to something else, and it was all kind of awkward. I remember thinking there was something else here, like maybe he had a connection to Wims. But then when he sent him off to Camarillo, I knew he wasn't doing the guy any favors. What do you mean? Look, you just spent a couple hours with the case, and you know how it's going to go. This is a plea, jail time, counseling, and supervision. That's what it was before he was sent to Camarillo. So Wims' time there wasn't really necessary. Jerry just prolonged the inevitable. I nodded. She was right.
Sending a client to the psych ward at Camarillo wasn't doing him any favors. The mystery case was getting more mysterious. Only, my client was in no condition to tell me why. His lawyer, Vincent, had kept him drugged up and locked away for 3 months.
Okay, Joanne. Thanks. I was interrupted by the clerk, who called court into session, and I looked up to see Judge Friedman taking the bench.
Angel Romero was one of those human interest stories you read in the paper every now and then. The story about the gangbanger who grew up hard on the streets of East L.A., but fought his way through to an education and even law school, then turned around and gave back to the community. Angel's way to give back was to go into the public defender's office and represent the underdogs of society. He was a lifer in the PD and had seen many young lawyers, myself included, come and go on their way to private practice and the supposed big bucks that came with it. After the Wims hearing, in which the judge granted the motion to continue in order to give Giorgetti and me time to work out a plea, I went down to the PD's office on the 10th floor and asked for Romero. I knew he was a working lawyer, not a supervisor, and that most likely meant he was in a courtroom somewhere in the building. The receptionist typed something into her computer and looked at the screen.
Department 124, she said.
Thank you, I said. Department 124 was Judge Champagne's courtroom on the 13th floor, the same floor I'd just come from. But that was life in the CCB. It seemed to run in circles. I took the elevator back up and walked down the hall to 124, powering my phone down as I approached the double doors. Court was in session, and Romero was in front of the judge, arguing a motion to reduce bail. I slid into the back row of the gallery and hoped for a quick ruling so I could get to Romero without a long wait. My ears perked up when I heard Romero mention his client by name, calling him Mr. Scales. I slid further down the bench so I had a better visual angle on the defendant sitting next to Romero. He was a white guy in an orange jail jumpsuit. When I saw his profile, I knew it was Sam Scales, a con man and former client. The last I remembered of Scales, he had gone off to prison on a plea deal I'd obtained for him. That was 3 years ago. He obviously had gotten out and gotten right back into trouble. Only this time, he hadn't called me. After Romero finished his bail argument, the prosecutor stood up and vigorously opposed bail, outlining in his argument the new charges against Scales. When I had represented him, he had been accused in a credit card fraud in which he ripped off people donating to a tsunami relief organization. This time, it was worse. He was once more charged with fraud, but in this case, the victims were the widows of military servicemen killed in Iraq. I shook my head and almost smiled. I was glad Sam hadn't called me. The public defender could have him. Judge Champagne ruled quickly after the prosecutor finished. She called Scales a predator and a menace to society and kept his bail at $1 million. She noted that if she'd been asked, she probably would have raised it. It was then that I remembered it had been Judge Champagne who had sentenced Scales in the earlier fraud. There was nothing worse for a defendant than coming back and facing the same judge for another crime. It was almost as if the judges took the failings of the justice system personally. I slouched in my seat and used another observer in the gallery as a blind, so that Scales couldn't see me when the court deputy stood him up, cuffed him, and took him back into lockup. After he was gone, I straightened back up and was able to catch Romero's eye. I signaled him out into the hallway, and he flashed 5 fingers at me. 5 minutes. He still had some business to take care of in the court. I went out into the hallway to wait for him and turn my phone back on. No messages. I was calling Lorna to check in when I heard Romero's voice behind me. He was 4 minutes early.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo, catch a killer by the toe. If his lawyers holler, let him go. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Hey, bro.
He was smiling. I closed the phone and we bumped fists. I hadn't heard that homespun jingle since I was with the PD's office. Romero had made it up after I'd gotten the not guilty verdict in the Barnett-Woodson case back in 92.
What's up? Romero asked.
I'll tell you what's up. You're guzzling my clients, man. Sam Scales used to be mine. I said it with a knowing smile, and Romero smiled right back.
You want him? You can have him. It's one dirty white boy. As soon as the media gets wind of this case, they're gonna lynch his ass for what he's done.
Taking war widows' money, huh?
Stealing government death benefits. I tell you, I've repped a lot of bad guys who did a lot of bad things, but I put Scales up there with the baby rapers, man. I can't stand the guy.
Yeah, what are you doing with a white boy anyway? You work gang crimes. Romero's face turned serious, and he shook his head. Not anymore, man. They thought I was getting too close to the customers. You know, once a vato, always a vato. So they took me off gangs. After 19 years, I'm off gangs.
Sorry to hear that, buddy.
Romero had grown up in Boyle Heights in a neighborhood ruled by a gang called Cuatro Flats. He had the tattoos to prove it, if you could ever see his arms. It didn't matter how hot a day was, he always wore long sleeves when he was working. And when he represented a banger accused of a crime, he did more than defend him in court. He worked to spring the man from the clutches of gang life. To pull him away from gang cases was an act of stupidity that could only happen in a bureaucracy like the justice system. What do you want with me, Mick? You didn't really come here to take scales from me, right? No, you get to keep scales, Angel. I wanted to ask you about another client you had for a while earlier this year, Eli Wims. I was about to give the details of the case as a prompt, but Romero immediately recognized the case and nodded. Yeah, Vincent took that one off me. You got it now with him being dead? Yeah, I got all of Vincent's cases. I just found out about Wims today. Well, good luck with him, bro. What do you need to know about Wims? Vincent took it off me 3 months ago at least. I nodded. Yeah, I know. I got a handle on the case. What I'm curious about is Vincent taking it. According to Joanne Giorgetti, he went after it. Is that right? Romero checked the memory banks for a few moments before answering. He raised a hand and rubbed his chin as he did so. I could see faint scars across his knuckles from where he'd had tattoos removed. Yeah, he went down to the jail and talked Wims into it. Got a signed discharge letter and brought it in. After that, the case was his. I gave him my file and I was done, man. I moved in closer to him. Did he say why he wanted the case? I mean, he didn't know Wims, did he? I don't think so. He just wanted the case. He gave me the big wink, you know? No. What do you mean? What's the big wink? I asked him why he was taking on a Southside homeboy who went up there in white people country and shot the place up. Pro bono, no less. I thought he had some sort of racial angle on it or something. Something that would get him a little publicity. But he just sort of gave me the wink, like there was something else. Did you ask him what? Romero took an involuntary step back as I pressed his personal space. Yeah, man, I asked, but he wouldn't tell me. He just said that Wims had fired the magic bullet. I don't know what the hell he meant, and I didn't have any more time to play games with him. I gave him the file and I went on to the next one. There it was again. The magic bullet. I was getting close to something here, and I could feel the blood in my veins start to move with high velocity. Is that it, Mick? I gotta get back inside. My eyes focused on Romero, and I realized he was looking at me strangely. Yeah, Angel, thanks. That's all. Go back in there and give him hell. Yeah, man, that's what I do. Romero went back toward the door to Department 124, and I headed off quickly to the elevators. I knew what I would be doing for the rest of the day and into the night. Tracing a magic bullet. I entered the office and blew right by Lorna and Cisco, who were at the reception desk looking at the computer. I spoke without stopping on my way to the inner sanctum. If you two have any updates for me or anything else I should know, then come in now. I'm about to go into lockdown. And hello to you too, Lorna called after me. But Lorna knew well what was about to happen. Lockdown was when I closed all the doors and windows, drew the curtains, and killed the phones, and went to work on a file and a case with total concentration and absorption. Lockdown for me was the ultimate do not disturb sign hanging on the door. Lorna knew that once I was in lockdown mode, there was no getting me out until I had found what I was looking for. I moved around Jerry Vincent's desk and dropped into the seat. I opened my bag on the floor and started pulling out the files. I viewed what I needed to do here as me against them. Somewhere in the files, I would find the key to Jerry Vincent's last secret. I would find the magic bullet. Lorna and Cisco came into the office soon after I was settled. I didn't see Ren out there, I said before either could speak. And you never will again, Lorna said. She quit. That was kind of abrupt. She went out to lunch and never came back. Did she call? Yeah, she finally called. She said she got a better offer. She's going to be Bruce Carlin's secretary now. I nodded. That seemed to make a certain amount of sense. Now, before you go into lockdown, we need to go over some things, Lorna said. Well, that's what I said when I came in. What have you got? Lorna sat down in one of the chairs in front of the desk. Sisko stayed standing, more like pacing, behind her.
All right, Lorna said. Couple things while you were in court. First, you must have touched a nerve with that motion you filed on the evidence in Patrick's case.
What happened? I asked.
The prosecutors called 3 times today, wanting to talk about a dispo.
I smiled. The motion to examine the evidence had been a long shot, but it looked like it might come through, and I would be able to help Patrick.
What's going on with that? Lorna asked. You didn't tell me you filed motions.
From the car yesterday. And what's going on is I think Dr. Vogler gave his wife phony diamonds for her birthday. Now to make sure she never knows it, they're going to float a deal to Patrick if I withdraw my request to examine the evidence.
Good. I think I like Patrick.
I hope he gets the break. What's next? Lorna looked at the notes on her stenopad. I knew she didn't like to be rushed, but I was rushing her.
You're still getting a lot of calls from the local media about Jerry Vincent or Walter Elliott or both. You want to go over them?
No, I don't have the time for any media calls.
Well, that's what I've been telling them, but it's not making them happy. Especially that guy from the Times. He's being an asshole.
So what if they're not happy? I don't care.
Well, you'd better be careful, Mickey. Hell hath no fury like the media scorned.
It was a good point. The media can love you one day and bury you the next. My father had spent 20 years as a media darling, but toward the end of his professional life, he'd become a pariah because the reporters had grown weary of him getting guilty men off. He became the embodiment of a justice system that had different rules for well-heeled defendants with powerful attorneys. I'll try to be more accommodating, I said. Just not now.
Fine.
Anything else to report?
I told you about Wren, so that's all I have. You'll call the prosecutor on Patrick's case?
Yes, I will call him. I looked over Lorna's shoulder at Sisko, who was still standing. Okay, Sisko, your turn. What have you got? Still working on Elliot, mostly in regard to Riltz and some hand-holding with our witnesses.
I have a question about witnesses, Lorna interrupted. Where do you want to put up Dr. Arslanian?
Shamiram Arslanian was the gunshot residue authority Vincent had scheduled to bring in from New York as an expert witness to knock down the state's expert witness at trial. She was the best in the field, and with Walter Elliott's financial reserves, Vincent was going with the best money could buy. I wanted her close to the downtown CCB, but the choice of hotels was limited. Try Checkers first, I said, and get her a suite. If they're booked, then try the Standard and then the Kyoto Grand. But get a suite so we have room to work.
Got it. And what about Muniz? You want him in close too?
Julio Muniz was a freelance videographer who lived in Topanga Canyon. Because of his home's proximity to Malibu, he had been the first member of the media to respond to the crime scene after hearing the call out for homicide investigators on the sheriff's radio band. He had shot video of Walter Elliott with the sheriff's deputies outside the beach house. He was a valuable witness because his videotape and his own recollections could be used to confirm or contradict testimony offered by sheriff's deputies and investigators. I don't know, I said. It can take anywhere from 1 hour to 3 hours to get from Topanga to downtown. I'd rather not risk it. Sisko, is he willing to come in and stay at a hotel? Yeah, just as long as we're paying and he can order room service. Okay, then bring him in. Also, where's the video? There are only notes on it in the file. I don't want the first time I look at the video to be in court. Sisko looked puzzled. I don't know, but if it's not around here, I can have Muniz dub off a copy. Well, I haven't seen it around here, so get me a copy. What else? Couple other things. First, I got my source on the Vincent thing, and he didn't know anything about a suspect or this photo Boss showed you this morning.
Nothing?
Nada.
What do you think?
Does Bosch know your guy's the leak and is shutting him out? I don't know, but everything I was telling him about this photo was news to him.
I took a few moments to consider what this meant. Did Bosch ever come back and show the photo to Wren? No, Lorna said. I was with her all morning. Bosch never came in then or after lunch.
I wasn't sure what any of this meant, but I couldn't become bogged down with it. I had to get to the files.
What was the second thing? I asked Sisko.
What? You said you had a couple other things to tell me. What was the second thing? Oh, yeah.
I called Vincent's liquidator, and you had that right. He's still got one of Patrick's longboards.
What's he want for it?
Nothing.
I looked at Sisko and raised my eyebrows, asking where the catch was.
Let's just say that he liked to do you the favor. He lost a good client in Vincent. I think he's hoping you'll use him for future liquidations. And I didn't dissuade him from the idea, or tell him you usually don't barter property for services with your clients.
I understood. The surfboard would not come with any real strings attached.
Thanks, Sisko. Did you take it with you?
No, he didn't have it at the office. But he made a call, and somebody was supposed to bring it in to him this afternoon. I could go back and get it if you want.
No, just get me an address, and I'll have Patrick pick it up.
What happened with Bruce Carlin? Didn't you debrief him today? Maybe he's got the Muniz tape.
I was anxious to hear about Bruce Carlin on several levels. Most important, I wanted to know if he had worked for Vincent on the Eli Wims case. If so, he might be able to lead me to the magic bullet.
But Sisko didn't answer my question.
Lorna turned and they looked at each other, as if wondering which one of them should deliver the bad news.
What's wrong? I asked.
Lorna turned back to me.
Carlin's fucking with us, she said.
I could see the angry set of her jaw, and I knew she reserved that kind of language for special occasions. Something had gone wrong with Carlin's debriefing, and she was particularly upset.
How so?
Well, he never showed up at 2 like he said he would. Instead, he called at 2, right after Wren called and quit, and gave us the new parameters of his deal.
I shook my head in annoyance.
His deal? How much does he want?
Well, I guess he realized that at $200 an hour he wouldn't make much, since he was probably going to bill only 2 or 3 hours tops. That's all Sisko would need with him. So, he called up and said he wanted a flat fee, or we could figure out things on our own.
Like I said, how much?
$10,000.
You gotta be fucking kidding me.
My words exactly.
I look from her to Sisko. This is extortion. Isn't there a state agency that regulates you guys? Can't we come down on his shit somehow?
Sisko shook his head.
There are all kinds of regulatory agencies, but this is a shady area.
Yeah, I know it's shady. He's shady. I thought that for years.
What I mean is, he had no deal with Vincent. We can't find any contract, so he's not required to give us anything. We simply need to hire him, and he's setting his price at $10,000. It's a bullshit ripoff, but it's probably legal. I mean, you're the lawyer. You tell me.
I thought about it for a few moments, and then tried to push it aside. I was still riding on the adrenaline charge I'd picked up in the courthouse. I didn't want it to dissipate with distractions.
All right, I'll ask Elliot if he wants to pay it. Meantime, I'm going to hit all the files again tonight, and if I get lucky and crack through, then we won't need him. We say fuck you and are done with him.
Asshole, Lorna muttered.
I was pretty sure that was directed at Bruce Carlin and not me.
Okay, is that it? I asked. Anything else?
I looked from one face to the other. Nobody had anything else to bring up.
Okay then, thank you both for all you've been putting up with and doing this week. Go out and have a good night.
Lorna looked at me curiously.
You're sending us home? She asked.
I checked my watch.
Why not? I said. It's almost 4:30, and I'm going to dive into the files and I don't want any distractions.
You two go on home. Have a good night and we'll start again tomorrow.
You're going to work here alone tonight? Sisko asked.
Yeah, but don't worry. I'll lock the door and I won't let anybody in, even if I know him.
I smiled. Lorna and Sisko didn't. I pointed to the open door to the office. It had a slide bolt that could be used to lock it at the top of the door frame. If necessary, I would be able to secure both outside and inside perimeters. It gave new meaning to the idea of going into lockdown.
Come on, I'll be fine. I've got work to do.
They slowly, reluctantly, started to make their way out of my office.
Lorna, I called after them.
Patrick should be out there. Tell him to keep hanging. I might have something to tell him after I make that call.
I opened the Patrick Henson file on my desk and looked up the prosecutor's number. I wanted to get this out of the way before I went to work on the Elliot case. The prosecutor was Dwight Posey, a guy I had dealt with before on cases and never liked. Some prosecutors deal with defense attorneys as though they are only one step removed from their clients.
as pseudo-criminals, not as educated and experienced professionals, not as necessary cogs in the winding gears of the justice system. Most cops have this view, and I can live with it, but it bothers me when fellow lawyers adopt the pose. Unfortunately, Dwight Posey was one of these, and if I could have gone through the rest of my life without ever having to talk to him, I would have been a happy man. But that was not going to be the case.
"So, Holler," he said after taking the call, "they've got you walking in a dead man's shoes, don't they?"
"What?"
"They gave you all of Jerry Vincent's cases, right? That's how you ended up with Henson."
"Yeah, something like that. Anyway, I'm returning your call, Dwight. Actually, your three calls. What's up? You get the motion I filed yesterday?" I reminded myself that I had to step carefully here if I wanted to get everything I could out of the phone call. I couldn't let my distaste for the prosecutor affect the outcome for my client.
"Yes, I got the motion. It's sitting right here on my desk. That's why I've been calling."
He left it open for me to step in.
"And?" "And, we're not going to do that, Mick."
"Do what, Dwight?"
"Put our evidence out there for examination."
It was looking more and more like I had struck a major nerve with my motion.
"Well, Dwight, that's the beauty of the system, right? You don't get to make that decision. A judge does. That's why I didn't ask you. I put it in a motion and asked the judge."
Posey cleared his throat.
"No, actually, we do this time," he said. "We're going to drop the theft charge and just proceed with the drug charge. So you can withdraw your motion, or we can inform the judge that the point is moot."
I smiled and nodded. I had him. I knew then that Patrick was going to walk.
"Only problem with that, Dwight, is that the drug charge came out of the theft investigation. You know that. When they popped my client, the warrant was for the theft. The drugs